Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much power do we have over whether we are in control of or controlled by our fears? And what does it take to develop the kind of courage required to live the way we want to live? While many animals experience and react to fear, humans are unique in that we can be afraid not only of immediate threats, but of things yet to happen. We fear loneliness and intimacy, failure and success, and the uncertainties of both life and death. But our lives are also defined by our choices to face the things that terrify us and to move on even after experiencing crushing setbacks. Dr. Gordon Livingston is an adopted son, a father, and a Vietnam veteran. He draws on all these facets of his life, along with his training and experiences as a psychiatrist, in his thoughtful new book, The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. Gordon, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Why is fear such a central issue to modern life, or is it simply a central issue to human life?
Yeah, no, I think it is a central issue in both respects. I mean, at one time, it was a very adaptive emotion when we lived on the African plains and had to deal with animals much larger than we were, because then it would alert us to danger. But now our fears have shifted from survival to other sorts of things, some of which you mentioned, fears of intimacy, of rejection, the fears of loss of loved ones, and so we're still reacting, however, with the same fight or flight reaction.
And it's clear that the media and certain politicians and other people who want to exert some control over us have learned that fear is a really powerful way to gain an audience or to motivate people to do something.
Oh, that's right. And of course, Richard Nixon said fear is what really motivates people, not love. They don't teach you that in Sunday school, but that's the truth. And he's got something there. And so I think we are manipulated by our fears, by politicians for power, and by the media for profit. And I think the result is that a lot of us carry around a lot of unnecessary anxiety.
Obviously, as you mentioned, this is a defense mechanism that was sort of evolved into us to keep us alive. How do people realize that fear is taking over their lives?
Well, if their lives are being constrained in some way, I mean, I as a psychiatrist, I see a lot of fearful, anxious people whose lives have shrunk because the natural response to fear is avoidance, if we begin to avoid those things that frighten us, for example, driving or heights or tunnels or flying or whatever it is, our lives shrink, and ultimately they can shrink to the size of our own homes, and so people lose some of the freedom of choice that is a sign of mental health.
You write that dying is at the heart of all fears, but you remind us that it is dying that makes life important. Talk about that.
Well, dying is the Native American, in the old Native American saying, we live forever, there would be no such thing as courage. And I think that that's true. Dying lends immediacy and urgency to our lives, but it also simultaneously frightens us. And so we become very afraid of the process of growing older, for example, and we're afraid of illnesses of various sorts, and so it has a major impact on our lives. But it also lends our lives a poignancy and faces us with the need to distill a sense of meaning, even though we're here only temporarily.
What do you see as the relationship between fear of death and faith in a higher power?
Well, I think faith in a higher power is a natural human reaction to fear of death. None of us like to believe that we cease to exist at the moment that we die, and so I think that most religions depend on their promise of immortality. for their strength, and a lot of people find comfort in that. And since no one really knows what happens to us when we die, I think that it's certainly understandable that people would have beliefs in a higher power.
It is remarkable, though, and you write a bit about this, that even those who have a very strong faith that there is a life after death, we humans really want to keep living just as long as possible.
Yes, that's an interesting paradox, isn't it? That heaven is painted in such vivid and attractive colors, but no one seems to be in a hurry to get there, even people who are very devout believers. And I think that expresses the doubt that no matter how faithful and religious we are, exists somewhere in our brains because no one has returned to reassure us about the existence of heaven. We're all a little bit worried about it, even though we may believe in it. So I think that's a natural human fear.
Gordon, talk about this. We have varying levels of sort of natural risk tolerance, but it turns out none of us is particularly good at objective risk assessment. So we fear plane crashes when we should really be worried about driving to the grocery store for that gallon of milk.
Exactly. And it is true that we're afraid of the wrong thing, so that we get preoccupied with things like a child abduction and shark attacks and killer bees, when the real threats to our welfare, like, as you point out, driving our cars and climate change, for example, don't affect us in the same way. So I think that being more realistic about risk assessment is an important step to developing a sense of the world as it really is.
Perhaps, though, if we didn't worry about those things that are ultimately unlikely to do us any harm, and we did look at the things that are, that would paralyze us.
Well, we often feel helpless in the face of some of the large threats, like global warming, for example. And since we can't do much about that, we prefer to focus on something that we think we can control, such as whether or not a shark is going to eat us. As humans, we're constantly faced with evidence of how little control we have over the things that are really important, our own lives and the lives of those who love us. And I think one of the reactions to that rather fearful understanding is to try to exert control over those things we can, even though ultimately we know we're not going to be successful.
You write very movingly and candidly here about your experiences as a parent, including the fact that you lost two sons in a period of 13 months. And when the younger of those two sons died after an illness, you say it essentially stripped you of all illusion that you had any control.
Yeah, it was just a crushing and a humbling experience, and there was nothing, you know, there's no way to redeem those kinds of losses. But I think that most people respond to those kinds of things with a realization of how little control any of us have, and what a brief time we have to spend. And so it tends, I think, in most cases, to focus people on the moment and trying to distill from the moment as much meaning and pleasure as we can.
It is remarkable, though, that even in experiencing the worst thing that I think most people can imagine going through, there is a sort of liberation to understanding that you're not in control.
Well, yeah, I think that's right. Once you surrender the illusion of control that many of us carry around with us, you can either be scared to death at that realization, or you can face it. And the image of life that I often offer to patients is that we're like surfers. You know, we're on this wave and we're trying to ride it as well as we can, but we don't really control it, and we know that ultimately it's going to run out or that we're going to fall off. And so the challenge then becomes to enjoy the ride as much as we can.
What plays into resiliency? The fact that some people can survive a tragedy and come out okay in the end, and other people really are undone for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, that's hard to know, and it's hard to predict. It's like resiliency, I think, is a form of courage, and it's hard to predict ahead of time in combat, for example, which soldier is going to be courageous and which soldier is not. It's not randomly distributed in the population, so that we can only observe it in other people and in ourselves, for that matter, when we're confronted with things that require it, and so often people surprise themselves by how much resilience they're able to demonstrate, and how much courage they display when confronted with the need for it. But I do think I think one can cultivate it by being courageous in small ways in preparation for events that may never occur, but it's hard to get through life without having to be brave in some way, if only in the face of our getting old.
One thing that you learned in the Army was that courage, in the same way that fear is contagious, courage can be contagious.
That's right, and that's why we need models, and we seem in desperate search of heroes. So I think we've gotten kind of indiscriminate in our labeling of people. Now we've gotten to the point where everybody who puts on a uniform becomes a hero, and that we at some level we know that can't be true, but yet we do. So I think that the term has gotten degraded through overuse, and I think we need to think of it as requiring a choice. I think to be a hero, one has to choose, has to have a choice about it. I think it requires the willingness to take risk and the risk has to be of some benefit to somebody else. So a surgeon who performs a competent operation is not being heroic because he's not taking any risk. And a pilot who lands the airplane on the Hudson River is not being heroic because he didn't have a choice. So I think we need to be a little bit more conscious of who we attach that label to.
To what extent do you think that self-sacrifice is a form of courage?
Well, yes, there are many forms of courage. Of course, I mean, it's not just not just reacting physically to a threat, but it's also can be shown as a form of moral courage, the willingness to stand up to people in power on behalf of the truth and on behalf of other people. But it also can be demonstrated over a long period of time, as in taking care of a disabled child, so that there are lots of ways to demonstrate courage. There's no one form, and nobody is brave in all circumstances or all the time.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that we can be extraordinary in certain capacities and then sort of fall apart at other times.
Yeah, that's right. And everybody knows about people who performed admirably in combat and received decorations for that, and then come home and drink themselves to death. So it's nobody has it all the time.
My guest is Dr. Gordon Livingston. He's a psychiatrist and author of the new book, The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychiatrist and author Dr. Gordon Livingston. His new book is called The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Gordon, I want to go back to some of what you wrote about Vietnam, and there's certainly an opportunity to contrast that with the way that we have responded to soldiers who have fought in the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. It seems as if we learned from Vietnam not to blame the soldiers, but as you write, we did not learn to avoid going to war when we are not truly threatened.
Yeah, and I think that something has happened with these wars in South Asia now, in which there's a lot of guilt on people's parts that they, because they know at some level that we've asked a very small slice of our population to bear practically all the sacrifices that we at home have sacrificed very little, so we deal with that by celebrating the soldiers in a way that they were not celebrated in Vietnam. But I think we're kind of missing the point. I mean, this is heroism by proxy. We made a bad decision in sending them off to fight in a nation that didn't threaten us, and they paid a terrible price, and so many, 20% are coming back with PTSD, and the best we can offer them is a little applause and a thanks for your service. And so I think that's been a very unfortunate set of circumstances.
Why did it become so easy for everyone to sort of assume there was one right way to be a patriotic American at that point?
Well, we were frightened. I think that in some ways is the lesson of 9/11. We were well and truly terrorized, and frightened people don't make good decisions. And I mean, if you want to see the signs of fear, look what happened to the stock market. People wouldn't get back on airplanes for a long time, and so we were singing the national anthem and congratulating ourselves as being the home of the brave, but we weren't behaving in a very calm or a dispassionate way, and consequently we got manipulated into a couple of wars that have not worked out well and have been fought at terrible cost. And so I think we ought to face up to this and recognize that these were fearful responses as a nation, and to think about what we need to do to react with greater fortitude.
You also write that perfectionism is based on fear, and that struck me as so relevant in this era when I think particularly a lot of parents feel this need to be perfect themselves and to raise perfect children. You have to almost ask yourself what we are afraid of.
Yeah, that's right. Perfectionists tend to have this catastrophic sense that if things aren't perfect, they're terrible. And
yeah,
of course, we live in such an imperfect world that that it's hard for a perfectionist not to be pessimistic. And I think it's really important to cultivate hope, and hope is such an important component of courage, just like it is a component of love. And to do that, you have to have a kind of an optimistic sense that things are going to turn out okay, and it turns out that perfectionists are very frightened that they're not going to turn out okay, and so consequently they get preoccupied with control issues and trying to get lost in details and that's sometimes adaptive if you're a brain surgeon or if you're an accountant, but it's not very adaptive in daily life.
To what extent do you think optimism and pessimism are simply innate characteristics, and to what extent are they affected by our experiences and our choices?
Because I think it has to be both. Like a lot of other personality characteristics, I think it's probably a mixture of a genetic loading, but also life experience. If you're brought up with people who are pessimistic, it's hard to, and who think things nothing is going to turn out well, then it's hard to develop a sense of optimism in yourselves. But I think it's the greatest gift that parents can give their children is a hopeful sense of what the world contains and what we can do day to day and how to most important, how to age gracefully. The number of adults I know who look at their aging parents with despair, thinking that this is going to be their fate too. They're going to lose their attractiveness. They're going to lose their ability to do things, and they're going to complain all the time. And so I spend a fair amount of time trying to explain to people that a lot of these things are choices, at least the complaining part. None of us control the aging process itself, but we can control our attitude toward it.
It is remarkable that we, so many of us, wake up at 40 or 50 and look at our parents and are surprised to suddenly realize that this will be our fate too, as if we haven't had the opportunity throughout our lives to observe this in other people.
I know. It's as if no one explained the contract to us ahead of time, that this is kind of how life goes. You're young and you're physically capable, and that's gradually going to decline, and so you're going to have to find a strength elsewhere. As Emerson said, as we grow old, the beauty steals inward. Yeah. And I think that's true, and so it puzzles me when people, as they age, react with that surprise. Gee, this wasn't supposed to happen to me.
Well, I think, when you are young, you sort of walk around as if you earned that,
That's right. That's right. It's just an accident of birth, and so enjoy it while you can. There will be other compensations later if you're willing to look for them. But if all you can focus on is your physical beauty and your ability to play games, then disappointment is going to arrive sooner rather than later.
But you have this beautiful, really elegant explanation, which is that the aging process chips away at our sense of specialness.
That's right. It does. Suddenly we realize that, William Saroyan on his deathbed was supposed to have said, I always knew that everyone had to die, but somehow I thought they'd make an exception in my case. And I think we all kind of carry that around in our heads, and when it becomes obvious that we are all growing older and are going to face our mortality at some point, some people react with surprise.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak first to Pushpa in Dallas. Hi, Pushpa.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
This is a question, Dr. Livingston. Do you think fear is originally from the belief that you are separate from your inner consciousness? The world is all identified by its, for example, I am Pushpa, but that is not the real me. That is only a body that is carrying the beautiful consciousness that is eternal. So when we believe that the consciousness inside is separate from my body, when I'm not able to identify for my internal what I am, that is when I have fear and I lose trust.
I think you're onto something there, and that is that fear in its most primitive sense is just a fear of extinction and a fear that we are our bodies, and that if we don't survive physically, then we don't survive at all. And I think if people do develop a sense of consciousness that's separate from that, and whether it's based on religion or spirituality of some other sort, I think that helps us be more composed in the face of our mortality.
You talk about the courage required to love, and I think that's another lesson that comes with time, that love is not so much an emotion that you feel and experience, but in many cases it's a choice.
Yes, and people puzzle over the definition of love, and my response to that is, we love someone when their needs and desires rise to the level of our own, or exceed the level of our own, and that is the unless we can say that, than whatever we're feeling for another human being. And, and unless we can demonstrate that in action, that whatever we're feeling is not, it may be affection, it may be respect, but it's not love.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Jeff in Arlington. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question about, I think I pretty much understand, have a grasp on how courage relates to rational fears, like if, you know, afraid of being shot or afraid of falling off of a tall building. But I just wondered if maybe you could address the correlation between courage and irrational fears, like phobias. And I'll take my answer up here.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, phobias, fortunately, are in some ways the easiest kinds of fears, as opposed to generalized anxiety, which doesn't have a focus. But if one is phobic about something, you know, like flying or closed spaces and so on, people can be desensitized to that. And I often use the when I was young, I was in the military, and it became necessary to learn how to jump out of airplanes, which I was pretty apprehensive about it. But I found out something interesting, and that is, not only did we help each other do that, but also after we'd done it a few times, the fear was becoming less, and after we'd done it perhaps 25 times, we were enjoying it. So the moral of that story is that that if you confront these things that you may be afraid of, especially the ones that are irrational, like phobias, then it gets better. The problem is it gets better gradually, but the converse of that is that if you avoid these things, if you're afraid of going over bridges, for example, and you avoid that at all costs, that fear is going to grow. And depending on how badly you need to get over bridges, that can put a constraint on your life. So, I think that the irrational fears in some ways are easier to treat.
Do you find that most of us, aside from those who are phobic, most of us feel entitled to our fears?
Well, the way people cling to them would suggest that, right, wouldn't it? I mean, I think that people just, for example, people who are afraid of crowds, just as a matter of course, just avoid, you know, going to movie theaters or sometimes the grocery store, and it seems to me that they don't give it a second thought unless it really interferes with their lives. So in that sense, I think we do sort of cling to our fears and make them worse by avoidance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hello again. Oh,
hi.
Down for a moment. Oh, I'm there. Trouble with me.
You got that radio turned off?
Yes. This
All
is
right.
Another one about phobias.
You've had
if the doctor could explain why I've suffered all my life from arachnophobia, which is silly because there's no dangerous large spiders in Britain, so it's something that's always puzzled me. Why? What causes it? Are you born
yeah,
with
they're,
it?
Yeah, these things are really hard to pinpoint in terms of their origin. I mean, there's some fears, like fears of insects and fears of snakes and so on, that seem to be universal, but they're much worse in some people than others. So here's the question, and that is, how important is this in terms of your daily life? I mean, it seems to me that we're not around spiders very much, and if avoidance is not a problem, then you can do that. If you wanted to do something about it, then there's the technique known as systematic desensitization, in which one gradually approaches the feared object, in this case spiders, in more and more controlled situations. I've had patients, for example, who are afraid of birds, which causes a lot of constraints when they try to go out. But if they're gradually helped to approach cage birds, for example, and then flying birds, they get rid of that, and so that's a form of courage, isn't it? That's approaching things that frighten us and confronting them. So yeah, the origins I just don't know about.
It's interesting that you mentioned earlier that in some ways phobias are the easiest thing to cope with. We can desensitize people to the things that make them irrationally afraid. You also write in the book and include some diary entries from a young woman named Allison Caldwell, who was diagnosed as a girl with an autoimmune disorder that ultimately ended her life at 25. And so fear was something she lived with all the time. And she was quite well aware that her problems were only going to increase in magnitude until her life ended.
Yeah, and she just approached that with enormous steadfastness and tremendous creativity. I mean, she began to win prizes for her knitting and flabbergasted designers with her architectural skills, and so she was never defeated by this. I mean, she was virtually confined to her house by this illness, and yet she lived a very full life. Educated herself by reading widely and with the help of her very attentive mother, lived a very full life in the face of this knowledge that things were only going to get worse for her physically.
Yeah, I think what struck me most about reading about her and reading her own words was her choice. She could have gone either way with this.
Yeah, she could have, and so because the treatments changed her physically. I mean, her body deteriorated slowly, and she was swollen with steroids. And yet, she adapted to each of these insults with remarkable steadfastness. So I tell that story, or I show her journal entries, which tell that story, just because there is so much courage in it.
Dr. Gordon Livingston is my guest. He's a psychiatrist and author of the new book, The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email. The address is think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Gordon Livingston. He is a psychiatrist and author of the new book, The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Gordon, I'm curious about the relationship between fear and courage and humor.
Humor is is one of what Freud called mature defenses, and we all need defenses against anxiety. And humor is one of the best. Mark Twain once said, "There is no humor in heaven because it depends on sorrow more than joy." And I think he's onto something there. There's something about humor that carries with it a sense of shared fate. You know, that we know we're going to be overwhelmed ultimately in our lives, but things may be serious, but they may also be funny. And so I think that and in very high stress situations like combat, you won't be surprised to hear there's a fair amount of humor, although some of it rather dark, that sustains people in times of crisis. So I think humor is just a wonderful defense against things that frighten us.
Were you aware in your most challenging moments in Vietnam, okay, this is something I will not forget?
Oh, yeah. And I was very aware that this was one of the most important experiences that I was ever going to go through, and that, in a sense, I mean, that's why I volunteered for it. I had the distinct feeling that something was happening there, and that being there would tell me a lot about myself.
So, did you not resist the ways that war could have changed you, or did change you?
Well, I lodged a protest against the war after I'd been there for a while, and so I took a kind of a different route out, because I felt the waste, and I felt the sense of loss, and what I saw happening didn't seem to me to be in the national interest, and so that was my way out of there, and it left me with a little bit less vulnerable to a sense of meaningless. That so many Vietnam veterans felt, that they had done and seen things that that no person should have to see, and that in the end they'd been lied to, and that what they were doing was really not worth the cost.
Hmm. You define cowardice as the incapacity to love anything but oneself.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, we're all going to find situations in which we don't behave as bravely as we think we ought, but it is, I think, that those become defining moments for us from which I hope we can learn. But I do think that that's what keeps us from being brave, is the idea that somehow we ourselves are more important than any idea or any other human being, and that's not a... And that's why people who are cowards are held in such low esteem.
Hmm. Is cowardice responsible for the failure of relationships? You write about people who fear commitment, or they fear intimacy.
Yeah, I think cowardice is such a strong word.
It's a loaded
word.
Yeah,
self-protectiveness, I think, is the source of so much. So many problems in relationships. People, you know, allowing oneself to love another human being, particularly one to whom we're not related by blood, seems like such a risk. And all of us have had our hearts broken in that process. And so to take that risk again requires a fair amount of hope and a fair amount of courage. And I think some people are just not willing to do it. So you have things like prenuptial agreements, for example. What kind of commentary is that on the relationship, that you require a contract from somebody who you intend to spend the rest of your life with?
There's that illusion of control again.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's exactly what it is. But whenever I see one, I kind of shake my head and think. That relationship is in trouble already.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Rob in Fort Worth. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Yeah,
thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your book is going to help people, man. It's really wonderful the way you articulate this, and it's something we all need to understand better, these issues. But I have a dumb question, a conspiratorial question. What do you feel about the hero worship we have for comic book heroes and movie heroes who save the day? And do you think that could be part of a propaganda machine that would quell our natural reaction to our oppressors?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. The fact that we make heroes out of our movie stars and athletes gives us a distorted picture of what heroism really is, because it's not, true heroism is not a fantasy, and it's not, as it's so often portrayed in movies, a sign of ultimate control, you know, where the hero can automatically beat up everybody else or survive. I mean, that's not That's not what life is. And then we conflate the characters that people play with the people themselves and make cultural icons out of people who simply speak the lines that others have written for them. So I think that I think that is very confusing, and so those are definitely people who are in most cases don't fit the heroic mold.
And yet we've always, like throughout, as early on as we can find, you know, evidence of humans remembering stories and recording them in pictures or in words, we have made heroes out of some among us.
Well, yes, and that's the need that we all have is to have people, even if they're not realistic, who are who are heroic. But I think that we ought to spend more time looking for actual heroes and understanding what it takes to react to adversity with courage and with no clear guarantee that there's going to be a happy ending. So I think we get a kind of a distorted view of what to expect when we depend on the movies for our heroes.
It makes sense that courage often requires honesty with other people. I wonder if the real impediment is honesty with ourselves.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, it's said that one of the hardest things in life is to see ourselves as others see us, or to see ourselves as we really are. I mean, we all make up stories about who we are and where we came from. It turns out that most of what we remember about our past is distorted in some way when you compare it to other person's recollections of the same time. And so I think there is a lot of self-deception that we engage in the hope somehow that we can retain a good sense of ourselves, if not as heroes, at least as good people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I would like to ask the doctor about the relationship of fear and ego, and perhaps cowardice in ego.
Right. Well, yeah, ego is representing our sense of ourselves is what's really at risk, isn't it? I mean, this is the thing that we fear, this loss of ourselves, and those of us who have a particularly high opinion of ourselves are probably the most vulnerable to that. Those who have not been humbled sufficiently by life, or who imagined that our specialness exceeds that of anyone else. I think that really makes us very vulnerable to fear, because at some level we know that we can lose ourselves in an instant.
So many people would like to be able to cultivate courage in their children, and you remind us that this is really something that can be taught only by example.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that in some ways there's entirely too much lecturing that goes on between parents and children. I've always felt that that parents depend on, you know, you're supposed to talk with your children about this or talk with your children about that. What they're learning about life and what they're learning works and doesn't work in terms of human relationships is what they're observing in you and in your relationship with your spouse and in the way you treat them. And in the honesty with which you conduct your own life, so that's how people learn, and we learn all sorts of virtues that way: kindness and ability to love, and empathy, and courage as well. So we have to take what opportunities we have to behave well, and particularly in the face of our fears, if we expect our children to learn it.
You share in the book that you didn't learn until you were 35 years old that you'd been adopted. Do you understand what your parents were afraid of?
Yes, they were afraid that somehow I wasn't theirs, that there was this other figure in the world who had given birth to me. And of course, the state of Tennessee, in this case, cooperated with that by issuing a false birth certificate showing that my adopted parents were my birth parents. So my parents never felt comfortable in telling me about this, and it was a fear that somehow I'd go off, with my birth mother. Well, when I found that out, incidentally, at the age of 35, my mother had just died, but my father was still afraid of that. And so when I did search for my birth mother and find her, he was still frightened that somehow he would cease to be my father, even though I tried to reassure him that he had raised me and I knew who my father was. So that was a perfect example of how fears can interfere with even the closest of relationships.
It seems like it takes courage to forgive something like that, too.
Well, yeah, I guess so. They were a product of their time, and I guess I understood. The important thing was that they always set a good example for me of how to treat other people, and they loved me without reservation, and so I felt as though I couldn't really hold this against them.
Talk about what it takes to maintain one's own optimism and when your sense of your place in the world, when in your work you are dealing with people, albeit people you hope to help, but you are dealing with people who are often at the low point of their lives.
Well, yeah, but that's what sustains me, because if I'm with them for very long, I'm watching them mobilize. In almost all cases, I'm watching them mobilize these reserves of strength and courage and to face the thing, whatever it is that is inhibiting their happiness. After you've watched that for 40 years, you develop a pretty optimistic sense about people's ability to change themselves.
Do you think that most people are stronger than they realize?
Yes, I do. And I think that because we live such relatively safe and climate-controlled lives, that we're not often called upon to show much in terms of our reserves of courage. But when you look around at what people do in a crisis, it's pretty encouraging that people are more often than they expect able to rise to the occasion and demonstrate real courage.
Was this an easy book for you to write?
No, it was hard in some ways. I was writing about people I knew. I was writing about my son who had died. I was writing about a friend from West Point who'd been killed in Vietnam, and so in some ways it was a book that I thought was important, because I think these subjects are important, but no, I found it difficult, and with every one of these books I think to myself, am I just saying the same things over and over again, and is there anything new here, and I'm never really sure.
Dr. Gordon Livingston's new book is called The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. Gordon, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a great interview, Chris. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Jeff Whittington answered the phones today. He's senior producer of the show. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs we have scheduled, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.